the Tuileries in disguise and be ferried by hired carriage to one of the city gates. Here, Fersen would have a coach waiting to whisk them away to the northeast frontier, where the local army commander, the Marquis de Bouillé, could be relied on to protect the king while he planned his next move. Detachments of troops would be waiting at staging posts along the route to provide a relay of escorts. The entire journey would take 2 days. What should have been the trickiest part of the exercise, getting out of the heavily patrolled palace, went without a hitch. The king, his sister, the queen, and their two children, the dauphin disguised as a girl, found their way to the hired carriage under cover of darkness. With them was the children's governess, with forged papers declaring her the Baroness Korf. The children were to pass as the young Korfs, the senior royals as the Baroness's servants. By 2 o'clock in the morning, the whole party had transferred to the coach outside the city gate. By 5 o'clock the following afternoon, they had reached Châlons, 14 miles from where the first detachment of troops was due to meet them. At this point, everything started to go wrong. One of the coach wheels hit a stone post, breaking the traces and bringing the horses down. The resulting delay meant that the first detachment of troops wasn't there to meet them after all, having had to disband when accosted by suspicious villagers. The knock-on effect resulted in escorts further along the chain being stood down as the king's party failed to materialize as expected. By this time, the royal family's empty beds had been discovered back at the Tuileries, and the alarm had been sounded, provoking outrage on the streets of Paris. News of the royal flight reached the village of Saint-Menehould, just 60 miles from the frontier, shortly before the king did. The local postmaster identified Louis from his picture on a banknote and rode ahead to Varennes, the next staging post, where he roused the town. When the royal party arrived there at 11 o'clock that evening, their papers were checked, and they were detained by a local official. The denouement was provided by a local judge, who had once lived in Versailles, and fell to his knees when he saw his sovereign standing before him. Louis knew that the game was up. "Yes," he said, "I am indeed your king." The third and last of Louis's enforced returns to Paris the following day was a grimmer affair than its predecessors. The royal family was greeted with open hostility on the road, while back in the city itself, where official notices had been posted reading, "Anyone who applauds the king will be beaten, anyone who insults him will be hanged," the silence of the crowds was perhaps even more unsettling. On the gates of the Tuileries Palace, someone had hung a sign saying, "House to let." The flight to Varennes was a turning point in the king's fortunes. After it, far fewer people would give him the benefit of the doubt, especially since he had left behind him a manifesto listing all his objections to the revolution. It also played to the growing fear of counter-revolutionary forces operating from outside the country, and to the growing radicalism of the political clubs proliferating inside it. The forces of counter-revolution were real enough. Ever since he led the first wave of émigrés in July 1789, Louis's reactionary brother, the Comte d'Artois, had committed himself to overthrowing the revolution. Countless others had joined him in the meantime, and there was a new exodus after Varennes, including, by the end of 1791, a staggering 60% of officers in the French army. Just days before the king's escapade, Artois had moved his headquarters from Turin to Koblenz, where he continued to drill his forces on German soil. The king's flight stoked anxiety that a major counter-revolutionary push was in the offing. On his return to the Tuileries, rumours were rife that Austrian forces under Marie-Antoinette's brother, the Emperor Leopold, were poised to invade the country to liberate him. Tensions mounted further at the end of August, when Leopold and the King of Prussia issued the Declaration of Pillnitz, aligning the crowned heads of Europe with the cause of the French monarchy. From now on, fear of counter-revolution was to be a potent force in French political life. At the same time, the flight changed the balance of radical politics within France. Since 1790, popular political clubs had been mushrooming in Paris and elsewhere. The most famous of them, the Jacobin Club, had originated in a caucus of radical deputies to the Assembly. Named after the former convent where it met, it spawned imitations all over the country. By the summer of 1791, there were 900 and counting. These radical clubs would be a springboard for many of the future leaders of the revolution, including a fastidious loner called Maximilien Robespierre, a key figure in the Paris Jacobins long before he was a force to be reckoned with in the Assembly. Paris had also seen an explosion of radical newspapers, including L'Ami du Peuple, the mouthpiece of one of the revolution's strangest and most incendiary apostles, Jean-Paul Marat. A failed former doctor, Marat had found his vocation in revolutionary journalism, denouncing those he regarded as enemies of the people and demanding, in the most bloodthirsty terms, their excision from the body politic. Varenne split the radicals down the middle. For firebrands, like the journalist Jacques-Pierre Brissot and the larger-than-life Georges-Jacques Danton, voice of the ultra-radical Cordelier Club, the king's attempt to leave the country amounted to abdication. In the days after the flight, they drew up a petition effectively demanding a republic. The move alienated those who still supported the Assembly's vision of a constitutional monarchy. It would also lead to a massacre. There was widespread fury in Paris when, on the 15th of July, the Assembly exonerated the king, implausibly blaming the flight on Bouillet instead. On the 17th of July, 3 days after the second anniversary of the fall of the Bastille, some 50,000 people gathered on the Champ de Mars to sign the Republican petition on the altar of the Fatherland. As they did so, two men were found hiding under the altar, where they had apparently been hoping to look up women's skirts. Accused of being spies, they were dragged out and lynched. When the news reached the Hôtel de Ville, the authorities saw their opportunity to clamp down on agitation that was threatening to get completely out of hand. Mayor Bailly declared martial law, and Lafayette marched a large contingent of National Guards to the Champ de Mars. The crowd greeted them with a volley of stones. Lafayette gave the order to fire, and some 50 people were killed. For a while, what became known as the Champ de Mars massacre seemed to have contained the capital's popular radicalism. In the following weeks, a clean-up operation saw further deaths and arrests and the virtual suspension of the radical clubs. Marat went underground and Danton temporarily fled to England. On the 14th of September, the king approved the Constitution of 1791, and on the 30th of September, the Assembly duly dissolved itself.